Okay, so this is an unedited first draft of the beginning of Da Nang, and it's pretty short. And then, I'll take that back. This is kind of a snippet from Saigon with Pete's chauffeur, Tuan. So let me, I'm going to read it out loud, and I'm going to change everything as I go to first person. I had it as, I changed it before to be omniscient point of view, but now I want to go first person. So anyways, Tuan, Pete's chauffeur, was waiting patiently by the World War II vintage Citroen. The black car was the car was in beautiful shape. Its finish just wiped clean of dust, reflected mirror-like the two men as they walked towards it. There's a good chance for me to say how tall Pete was and stuff like that. I get to embellish on that. There's one right there. It shimmered in the dazzling noonday sun like liquid. And the chrome sparkled and hurt the eyes. Tuan was proud of this car. Pete was not interested, almost contemptuous. He pushed his way gruffly past the small chauffeur, refusing to wait for the man to do his job, such as open the door. And he slid recklessly into the rear seat. Dave followed, and Tuan, his face scrunched up for a moment, trying as hard as not to show his frustration, closed the door behind them. Trying not to show his frustration and anger, closing the door behind him. Dave thought he, it's not Dave anymore, it's I, if it was me. So I thought I sensed a sense of heat within this small man. Just a quick flash of it. But then again, that was to be expected, I suppose. These people, for all their smiles and humbleness and condescending graciousness, must hate us. But then again, maybe not. Maybe compared to the French, we're not that bad, but I don't know. There was no reason for them to particularly like us, except we're spending some money here. That's not a bad reason. But not a real reason to like somebody. And the thought frightened me for a moment, and I lit up a Salem. I always light up a Salem when I get a little bit nervous. Pete must have sensed something, or maybe it was just that I had lit up, but he unwrapped a fresh cigar, bit off the end, and spit it out the window. Then he lifted the Havana with a practiced circular motion, with the flame from a special above a flame from a specially designed cigar lighter. That's interesting. The ride out to the airfield was uneventful, and Pete looked thoughtfully out the window, not speaking, and I looked out the other window, also not speaking. We quickly passed Bar Row, wound our way through the residential district, large stucco homes with well-manicured lawns, evenly spaced palms lining the road. Soon we were at the outskirts of the city, passing rows of shacks made mostly of flattened schlitz and coke cans. The inhabitants of this informal refugee camp squatted in front of their small shelters. Their puny, naked children played in the potholes full of dank, dark, brown water. The residue of the 10 a.m. shower. The town gave way to broad green rice fields as they approached the base of the air base. And then at the end of the road, which had now changed from a blacktop thoroughfare to red clay, was the outer perimeter fencing of Da Nang Air Base. Oh. Dene. Huh. That's interesting. Tuan also saw the poverty of the small, growing makeshift community. He knew it intimately. The child that Dave, that David noticed splashing in the mud hole was his son, Tui. Tuan lived on both sides of the war, the wealthy side of the Americans, like that bastard Pete, and the side of the people, the ones who had to leave their homes in the country, leave their farms, their small stores, their civilization, because the Americans What was that? There's something here. I'm reading something. I can't figure it out. Their civilization to leave like animals in a tin, to live like animals in tin shacks because the Americans, with the help of the aristocratic Catholics in Saigon, brought it about or whatever. Tuan hated them both. Although he was not a communist and had no political feeling one way or the other, he was a Buddhist. And as a Buddhist, it was unbearable to watch as his country, his Da Nang, was being raped and torn to shreds for ideology which were no more than meaningless slogans. The monks had begun to protest, emulating themselves in the main streets of Saigon. But Tuan felt this act of self-sacrifice was to be praised. It was a futile gesture, almost like spitting into the wind, utterly futile, and certainly self-destructive. The meeting last night was the first he could remember when all the members of the temple had agreed with one another. Something more than self-immolation had to be done. The Saigon puppets had to be removed from their sacred city, the Americans with them. And it would have to be done with force. Futile gestures were just that. Futile gestures. Just going. Huh. The planning conference, I think something like that, was called under the guise of a weekly meeting of the elders. At these meetings, community problems were argued with rare resolution, with rare solutions. But this night, Quan Lin couldn't be restrained. The meeting was held in the prefect's office. And Schoolmaster Yuan, a sly, small, bent man who spoke with chilling softness, leaned forward, putting both elbows on the varnished conference table. And to a group of four men who sat two to a side, opposite one another across the conference table. I don't remember any of this. What's going on here? His mind's eye wandered back to Bernie's castle. Oh, now he's in somebody else's head. Jesus. He experienced a brief moment of queasiness. He was amongst over 200 other top salespeople from around the world and was treated in courteous, if perfunctory, manner. Then he leaned back against softly upholstered rear seat of the Citroen, enjoyed a relaxing, long relaxing draw from his cigar, and remembered with relish his meeting with Bernie. Pete had recognized Bernie at once. They were walking in opposite directions. opposite directions. Down the long corridor which led from the main reception hall to the dining room. Pete was on his way to the first cocktail hour, feeling physically tired from his long trip and mentally excited about the week that lay ahead. Bernie, a short, balding man in his late 40s, walked toward Pete, a youthful bounce to his stride, following a mammoth cigar which seemed to pull his body purposely from down the corridor behind it. Bernie's gaze focused on through thick wire-framed glasses that added a good 10 years to his age. And I have a note here. What is it? It says here, the whole point of this scene is to show the reader how Pete emulates his mentor Bernie Cigar. Such things as this place is a good mine. Nothing is outside the realm of possibility. Mutual funds are the only solution that will enable most people to reach financial independence. That's interesting note. Where are we now? Added a sir at the end of his statement. Bernie yanked a cigar from his mouth and condescended to look in Pete's direction. A Cheshire cat smile spread across his pudgy face. His hazel eyes flashed with energy. Peter Vanderwater! Well, son, I've heard a lot of good things about you. France, isn't it? Pete felt a bit hurt. The great man didn't know about his operation, but he took care to be tactful. You're close, sir. Vietnam was, after all, a French possession. With the mention of Vietnam, Bernie stopped short. It took Pete a couple of strides to come to a short, stumbling halt a few feet past Bernie. Bernie appeared not to notice his clumsiness, as a broad smile still something to his plump face. Vietnam? And that's where we're going to make our fortune. My God, man, you're sitting on a gold mine. If I were only in better health, Vietnam would be the place for me. Tell me about the business climate out there. All I see are the order receipts. It's how you go about getting those orders that interests me. There's big money in mutual funds, but the only really big money comes from managing people. You know, I started as a fund salesman, sure. I was a teacher back in Hackensack, New Jersey. I didn't part-time during school season. And in the summer, I worked at it full-time, by the way. My income, $12,000 a year, and now, as you know, it's in the millions. Well, anyhow, I've been selling for two years. I had been selling for 2 years and had reached a point where I was making almost two times more per year selling mutuals than teaching school. So I figured that if I were to go at it full time, I could really make a killing. I quit my teacher's position, threw away my tenure, which, by the way, wasn't an easy decision at the time, and began full-time. And I'll say it again another way. It wasn't an easy decision then. I began selling mutual funds full-time. I worked out of the Jersey City office selling a variety of funds. Maybe you've heard of some of them. Oppenheimer, Fund of America, and Bond Street Leverage. After about a year, I worked my way up to VP of Marketing. I did this all out of a belief in myself, a belief in my product, but more importantly, with the firm knowledge that by selling mutual funds, I was helping the people, my clients, helping my clients find financial security. Pete moved up toward Bernie and stood like a rack in the center of the hall. What's a rack? Now we're onto something else. I don't even know what this is.